Welcome to the Dear Love Joy podcast, sponsored by Cooker, spelt Quirker, pronounced Cooker, and today is another special. Woohoo!
I can't get excited about Chris. I'm sorry.
Well, Chris is your friend, isn't he?
Yeah, he is. Yeah.
Well, welcome, we're going to welcome back. We can call him a friend of the show now. It's his second appearance. Last time he came on, he was talking about On the Game, which is his football book all about football, which I've thoroughly enjoyed. Great chat podcast from a few months ago. Check that one out. And today he's going to be discussing his new podcast, which Mark, you're producing.
I am. How did he get on here?
Yeah. It's a great chat, though.
It was brilliant. It was absolutely brilliant because I read these books. Obviously, he wrote them, and I know him. And he read these. He wrote these books, and he obviously gave them to me when he'd written them. And I was just like, I really hope I like these, and I really, really did. And so when we were discussing after we'd finished them all, I said, why don't we just do an audio book, like a free audio book for people? They'll get to, you know, they're not going to sit on a train and maybe read it, but they might be able to go for a jog or something and listen to them. And I've really been enjoying it. Very basic premise. It's about it's a story about a guy called Arthur Dando who toured with Laurel and Chaplin back in sort of Edwardian times, so at the very turn of the century. But it's got romance and it's got villainy and it's got the set. They're brilliant books.
Yeah, all based on true.
All based around historical fact. Yeah. He's actually got quite a good line that sells it, which is a historical comedy about the history of comedy. Yeah. It's quite good, I think.
Yeah, it's brilliant. Yeah, and it's a lovely chat, by the way. It's a lovely journey through comedy, right up to the modern day. Chris knows a lot about writing and writing comedy and writing books and writing
films. Well, he thinks he does.
Well, he does. might be your friend, but he does. He's, when was the last time you had a play on the stage? Never.
Oh, it was a couple of years ago, actually.
Evening with Gary Lineker. So, listen, let's meet him again. This is Chris England.
This is just a guide to modern life. Modern life is hard to get just right. It can frustrate you and annoy. And if it does, write into Dear Love Joy.
Chris, welcome back to my kitchen. I've bought you a present. It's a bottle of red wine, which I think, hopefully I'll be sharing with you later because I'm cooking.
I can see, thank you. Yeah, excellent.
We're actually doing this quite late at night, so... Early evening, and I'm going to cook a dinner for you later. Are you looking forward to my steak supper?
I look forward to a steak supper wherever and whenever it comes.
Okay, hopefully it'll be good. Thanks again for doing it. Last time you came on, you were discussing your book On the Game, which I thoroughly enjoyed, about football. What are your views on VAR? Because that's been introduced since the last time you came on the podcast.
Straight in. Yeah. Well, no, there was VAR, wasn't there? But when I wrote On the Game, because I went up to the World Cup, and there was VAR in the World Cup, and I think there was somehow they've managed to mess it up since the World Cup. It was much better during the World Cup, and it kind of added to the drama of it when the referee would run to the side of the pitch and look at the TV screen and, oh, I made a mistake, and then he'd point and blah blah blah, and there was a sort of drama to the sort of dot 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 moment while he was watching, and everyone could see he was watching the thing. And it's like, you know, Philip Schofield not telling you the winner of Dancing on Ice for 30 seconds or something like that, you know, and you're holding your breath while you're waiting for that. And they seem to have taken that additional drama away from it. And I think the problem with VAR as it is now, in the Premier League, the problem is the R, I think. I think, you know, video assistance is fine. And arguing against video assistance somehow feels a bit like arguing against justice, you know, and arguing against truth somehow. You know, now that they've shown you, as they've always been able to show you on Match of the Day or whatever, that so-and-so was offside and that goal shouldn't have counted. And somehow it feels like arguing against VAR... You're a stick in the mud and you're arguing against the truth, you know. But I think the problem with how they've set it up is not so much the video assistants as another referee. The referee in the actual match, I think, is undermined by the fact that there's another R buried in a bunker somewhere at Stockley Park, and that one is making the decisions, and the one on the pitch is the puppet who's saying, oh, they say it's a penalty, I'll wash my hands of the whole thing, it's a penalty.
Yeah, and unlike the cricket, the rugby, the tennis, we're not in on it either, we're not watching
the no we're not course. And I think it's cricket have made a very good job of, and tennis also actually, because it's they're line calls in tennis, it's basically analogous to the goal line technology, the tennis one. And the cricket one, they have some very good. I mean, they've had a few years to refine it now, and I'm sure they'll refine the football one if only the people in charge weren't so
rubbish,
dim. Really. but the cricket one, I mean, I think one thing that they could borrow from cricket is you know the where the ball is maybe half the ball is hitting the stumps, and they say, oh, that umpire's call, and it's whatever the umpire has said then gets to stand.
Yeah.
And I think if they had a margin like that...
That's a good idea.
For offside. So they say, well, he's... Because at the moment they're picking at, you know, someone's ear is in front of someone's shoulder, and they're drawing these bizarre little dotted lines as if to show you the truth, to show you justice, you know, and you have to... It has to be this tiny margin. I think if there was a margin of a couple of feet... which was, you know, in orange, say. And if it's within that, it's whatever the linesman said it was at the time.
Right.
It's the linesman's call.
That's a good idea.
And you need the linesman, you need the referee and the linesman to still be in charge of the game. Because the game that's at the top, the Premier League game, needs to be the same as the game that we're playing. The game that 58-year-old men like me are still playing, you know. And so you still need the referee in charge. You still need the linesman in charge. Yeah. And I liked it during the World Cup when the referees went and looked at, oh, and the referee needs to see he's made the mistake and he needs to change his decision. He doesn't need to have it changed over his head by someone that we can't see, we can't boo, we can't judge.
Yeah.
You know, we can't. They're not part of the process, you know, in a way.
Yeah.
And I think that they'd got VAR to a point where it added to the spectacle during the World Cup, and since then they've just dicked it up.
I think it's an interesting time though, because one of the reasons I hear that they don't do the replays, or we've always been told, is because they're scared of crowd violence. And I think it's about time that we just went, well, let's just chance it and see what happens.
Well, I think that hasn't happened in the cricket. If you look at, you know, if you go to a cricket match live, a test match live, or the World Cup, the cricket one day World Cup, where they showed it's become such a part of the spectacle. They've woven it into the spectacle.
That's what I mean. I think we can maybe change the way football fans are. I mean, they can still come along, they can boo, they can sing their songs, but there's still quite a violent aspect to football fans, isn't there? There's when they're hanging over the barriers doing the wanker sign.
But I think it's more horrible. Likely that people are going to get irritated to the point of violence by not knowing what the hell is going on.
Yeah.
It's more likely that they're going to take against the referee, say, because they can't see why he's made that decision. If you show him, and if you go to a test match live, as I say, the cricket, they show you the thing. They show you the thing that you're seeing on the TV. They show you on the big screen, and you see, oh yeah, he definitely edged that. You see the thing. I mean, cricket, the decisions that you make in cricket are materially different to the ones that you make in football. So it's not a direct analogy, not a direct similarity. But what they've done is what football should do, is used it to the point that it improves the spectacle. It makes it better to watch.
Yeah.
Because you know more.
And the ticket inside the stadium, the people have paid, it has to be a good experience. And at the moment, it's shifted back to the person watching on TV.
It's less than watching it at home. Yeah, and the person at home isn't enjoying it.
Yeah.
Isn't enjoying that aspect of it.
The other thing about it, always when we were in the lead up to it, people would, you know, the pundits, their favourite word is the referee inconsistency. And VAR will take away inconsistency. And now the pundits are constantly going, the problem with VAR is the inconsistency. You just literally can't get rid of that word.
Yeah, I know.
Punditry.
punditry is put together like Lego with three coloured blocks, basically. There's inconsistency, there's sloppy, and there's naive. And I don't think they necessarily know why any of these words apply to these things.
But I think the pundits are becoming like WWF. You've got soon as he comes out. And so it was not like that in my day.
He's like the hard man.
Yeah, and then you've got Roy Keane.
Who's the psychopath.
It's literally, they've got a character, yeah. haven't they? What's your yeah. character? What's your special power? What's your superpower? Yeah. I'm going to say this sort
of
stuff.
You know? And Jermaine Genus is slightly fey, yeah. and could... You know, present as he just did a program about vegan cooking.
Yeah,
you know? And then
Chris Sutton's devil's advocate.
Yeah, and you've got and you've got Carragher, who is a man who spits out of his car at children. So, you
know. All right, let's move away from that. Let's discuss. You're turning a trilogy of novels you've written into a podcast.
I am. Yeah.
Can you set up for the listener? When did you write the novels, and set up the basic premise of the book?
Well, it feels like to me that I've been writing the novels for almost forever, but they came out in 2014, 2016, 2018. The reason why there's three of them is that the original idea was just got so big that I reached a point where I had to stop and make it into two books, and then I had to stop again and make it into three books. So I've been writing it for a long while, for 10, 15 years probably. Mm. The idea that I have written is about the early career of comedians like Charlie Chaplin and Stan Laurel, that's the story that I was interested in, that Stan Laurel, of all people, should have been Charlie Chaplin's understudy when they were like 18, 19, 20. And they travelled around together for 4 years. And I wanted to tell that story because it's really interesting to me, because Stan Laurel is a huge favourite of mine, and Charlie Chaplin has never made me laugh in anything that I've ever seen him do. So, So I'm telling that story. To tell that story, I felt like Charlie Chaplin had spent his whole career trying to keep Stan Laurel down, trying to keep Stan Laurel under his thumb.
Is that a fact, or is that your opinion?
That was a fact.
Right. Okay. Yeah.
Same thing.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, exactly. In my house, that's the same thing. Well, no, I mean the things that kicked it off for me were because I came at it from the point of view of being a fan of Stan Laurel and Lauren Hardy, but Stan Laurel above all as the comedy genius of the 20th century. To find that he'd been, because he's 2 years younger than Chaplin, had been Chaplin's understudy for 4 years, and that this wasn't mentioned at all in Charlie Chaplin's autobiography, which he wrote at the end of his life, at the end of his career, let's say, in 1964. And Stan Laurel doesn't get a single mention, not a single mention. And they basically lived in each other's pockets for 4 years. They were shared rooms on tour. To hear Stan Laurel talk, Stan Laurel would never say a bad word about Charlie Chaplin, and Stan Laurel was very open about the time that they spent together, and would never have run him down, would never have had a bad word to say about him, as I say. But Charlie Chaplin simply didn't mention that he even knew Stan Laurel. And that I found a fascinating thing to start with, because it spoke to me about Charlie Chaplin needing to keep Stan Laurel in his place, that Charlie Chaplin was so protective of his own legend, his own sense of his own genius as an artist, that he couldn't allow the space for, let's say, his nearest rival. Let's say, you know, that there's a way of looking at it, that there were, of that generation, there were maybe three big comedy figures. There was Stan Laurel and Charlie Chaplin and Buster Keaton, say. And Charlie Chaplin never gave a moment's credit to the other two, right, and kept them in their place. And I found that fascinating. So I wanted to write that story from the point of view of a third character, who is my narrator, who is a guy called Arthur Dando, who was a real guy, who went on the tours with these two, with Chaplin and Stan Laurel.
He's real.
He's a real guy, yeah.
Oh.
But as a character in my books,
yeah,
he's kind of a composite of two or three people. But there was a real Arthur Dando, who I've made a contemporary of Chaplin and Stan Laurel, so that they can be rivals and go through the same experiences and be on the same tours. And the real Arthur Dando was on some of those things and got sacked off some of those things.
Right.
And it dipped in and out more than I've made it. But the real Arthur Dando did go on tour for the Fred Carno Comedy Company, the famous Fred Carno Comedy. It was the giants of the music hall, the Edwardian music hall, with Chaplin and Stan Laurel. And Arthur Dando, the real Arthur Dando, and Stan Laurel got sacked by Carno for asking for more money on a tour of America, came back to England and did a double act together. So basically Arthur Dando is Stan Laurel's first double act partner. And so in my second book, they're knocking around together. And then in my third book, he does a double act with Oliver Hardy. And right. So he's kind of cancelled out by history, kind of as like a maths equation. You know, there's Laurel and Dando, and there's Dando and Hardy, and you put them together, you end up with Laurel and Hardy thereafter. And he ends up introducing them and going his own way, kind of yeah. thing.
You'll have to give me some more knowledge on what the scene was like back in the day. My whole knowledge of
the musical,
yeah, it basically comes from the Steve Coogan film. That's literally what I probably know of that era.
Which Steve Coogan film?
The recent one about
Stan and Ollie.
Stan and Ollie.
Because Stan and Ollie is essentially the very end of Laurel and Hardy's career. It's after they've made their last film, actually, and it's a great film, Stan and Ollie. I think I really enjoyed it, but it doesn't tread on the toes of this at all, because the characters in the Fun Factory novels are 18, 19, 20, 21. And Stan and Ollie is the tail end. And that's not really musical. That's kind of post-Second World War variety, which is similar, but it's not quite the same. Because already by then, in the late 40s, the early 50s, the movies had kicked in and kicked musical in the teeth, and then television, you know. So the money that was there, the audiences that were there, were much less. In the period that I'm writing about in The Fun Factory, the Edwardian musical is before the cinema, is before television, is before the radio. The music hall is there's legitimate theatre, if you like, but music hall is the people's entertainment, is the thing that offers everything that cinema and television and radio offered subsequently, which is spectacle and music and comedy and a sort of working class thing as well. Mm. And so a typical music hall bill, let's say, would play 2-3 times a day, sometimes in London, in somewhere like Willesden or Ealing, would play to a theatre that's like 2,000 seats and would fill 3 times a day. And what they offered was not only comedy, because there'd be front of tabs acts in front of the curtains. There would be a solo comedian or a solo singer with a banjo, you know, or a solo clog dancer or something like that. And then the curtain would go up on spectacle. And that was what Fred Carno did. What Fred Carno provided were huge, spectacular comedy sketches. And his organisation, which was based at The Fun Factory, which is a real place, and in Camberwell, he would have from there maybe 10, 12 companies touring the country at any one time, sometimes in America as well, with just enormous routines. Some of the ones that I write about in the book, let's say the football match, because we're football guys.
Yeah.
There's a sketch called The Football Match. And imagine staging this now, okay? It would be in the middle of a music hall bill. It would be maybe first thing after the interval. And there would be, you know, there'd be solo singers, there'd be a couple of trick cyclists or tightrope walkers or something. It's a spectacle, but small. But then after the interval, you go to the football match, which is the FA Cup final on stage. Okay, so there's 22 players. There's a referee. And these players are not just actors. Some of these players are recent ex-international professional footballers who are on the uppers because they're, you know, the footballers weren't well paid in those days, and they're scratching around for a living. And they would be introduced one at a time. You know, here's Fred Spikesley of the Wednesday, who played for England, who scored the winning goal in the cup final, and in Sheffield he's a god, and people cheer, blah blah blah. And there's Crabtree from Aston Villa, there's Arthur Smith from Aston Villa, there's great players. And imagine doing that sketch now and introducing, oh, here's Paul Scholes, you know, or here's Jamie Carragher, boo, you know.
You don't like Jamie.
I don't like Jamie Carragher, but, no, but he likes me, so, you know, on we go. But
what was the sketch? No.
But the sketch was it was like a sketch. It was about half an hour long. It was in three acts. It involved a villain who was the part Chaplin first played, a villain with a you know, a cape and a moustache, who was trying to bribe the goalkeeper, which was the star part, to throw the cup final. So it was a game. It was a game about. It was a sketch rather about corruption, about, you know, comedy villainy, and it climaxed with the cup final, which the keeper was either going to throw or not. But it would not only have all the players and the referee on the stage, and some of them celebrities in their own right. You would have a crowd behind, and there would be 80 people, 80 extras. On a little sloping thing, and what they used to do was put the tallest ones on the front and the smallest ones at the back, so they gave a kind of illusion of perspective. Mm-hmm. And then behind them was like a psych, a curved sort of painted backdrop, like the thing they had at Arsenal, you know, when they pulled down the stand at one end, with faces on it that was matched to the scale of the people in front of it. So it looked like the crowd went on and on and on, and it, within this crowd, the faces would pull out. And people would run around behind and shout something, stick their face through and shout something, and then put the face back in and run to the next one. And so it looked like the crowd went all the way back. And they used to have, in front of this psych, this backdrop, they had these big electric fans on the floor pointing upwards. And each attached to the front of this psych, this backdrop, would be like stitched sleeves of jackets kind of thing connected to the painting. And when they turned the fans on, when there was a goal, they turned the fans on and all the arms on this painting would go, whoa, up. And all the hats, and there'd be hats, and they'd blow hats up in the air. So it looked like a huge, I mean, it was a huge, I mean, imagine getting 80 people on stage now, and yeah, 100 people on stage, because there's the players and stuff. And this is the thing, this is the difference between what the musical was like, what the Edwardian musical was like, and what you're talking about, the Stan and Ollie era variety, was much more, you know, double acts and people off them, out of the movies, and people out, you know, starting to cash in, starting to do what you would expect now, you know.
He was at that Simon Cowell, apparently, with his light show on X Factor. He was like the first series or something, first couple of series, he had £1 million spent on that stage.
Yeah.
And then he came in the next year, stage not good enough. £2 million. Yeah. It's a bit like what this guy's doing of that day. Yeah. How did he make it financially work for him then?
Because, well, you know, they were bringing in the Empire in Willesden or in Ealing or something. They were bringing in 2,000 people three times a day, you know, and it just worked. And they were paying these ex professional footballers next to nothing.
Yeah.
But for the extras and for the comedy performers in the Fred Carno company, They were paid less than they would be paid for a one-off gig, let's say, but it was 52 weeks a year. So in exchange for the security, they would take less money. So he didn't used to pay his performers what would be the going rate if they were a solo kind of thing, and which is why he would lose them. He would lose someone like, let's say, Charlie Chaplin's brother was a number one for Fred Carno, and he would get offers and go somewhere else, and someone like, and Carno couldn't hang on to those people because he wasn't paying the going rate for them as a star comedian.
Right.
But his philosophy always was that it was his name that put the bums on seats. And so everyone was a unit that was replaceable.
Right.
Everyone was
Who was he?
Where Carno.
He, yeah.
Well, he was a great entrepreneur and a great, quite a sort of genius, really, of because all these sketches came kind of out of his head onto the back of an envelope, and he would explain them to the companies that he was trying to get to do them, and they would all be playing in his head, and he would,
right.
And where he'd come from was he was an acrobat originally, and his name was Westcott, was Frederick Westcott. And he took up the name Carno just by accident, almost, after he was unemployed and hanging around down at a place called The Corner, which is in Waterloo, which is where acts and turns and actors used to go. And then producers who wanted someone at short notice would go down and find that's where all the unemployed actors were hanging around, waiting to be tapped up. And there was an acrobatic turn called the Three Carnos. who had gone missing and they needed a replacement for the bill that night. And Fred Karner had acrobat skills, picked up a couple of acrobats, put an act together in an afternoon and stood in for the three Karnos that evening, and it went very well, and they got booked for the following week. And that, whereupon the real three Karnos came back, and he changed his name from Karner with a C to Karner with a K, and carried on. So there were three Karners with a C, and then three Karners with a K.
Right.
And his upbringing was just doing whatever it was to make a pound, you know. And he used to do 21 shows a day when he was young. In a circus, and he would do his acrobatic show, but he would also do a comic sketch about Robin Hood. He would do there'd be a singing troupe, and he would do all of these things, and he would do 21 shows in a day at local fairs. And so he had a huge grounding in what worked for a live audience, and was able to translate that into a vast army of people, Fred Karner's army, they were called, and the actual army were called,
right,
during the First World War, and had a huge organisation based out of Camberwell, sent companies all over the country, touring all the time, and a huge repertoire of sketches that he'd devised that were all just huge.
Were the performers from all over Britain?
Yeah.
So they travelled down from Scotland and across from Wales.
Well, it was a great, it was a very sought after
career
gig, because you know, even though the money wasn't as good as you would get as a solo, you could learn your trade there and leave as a solo, you know, 5 years on from there. And a lot of very well thought of top line comedy performers never left. You know, never escape the apron strings, you know.
So what does an understudy mean, though? When you say, because obviously when Charlie Chaplin's on stage, there's just one of him.
No, so, not at all. That's not right.
Right.
You know.
Okay.
There are several of him. No.
Is it like the FA Cup and the World Cup?
No, but
Cup?
He's not. Within a Karno sketch, you're not a solo performer. You're the number one of a company, but then there are a couple of number twos, there are a couple of, you know, I know it's wee wee and poo, obviously, but it's there are a couple of number twos who are, and if the number one is ill or indisposed, one of the number twos steps up, because the cogs in a machine, you know. And so for example, the great sketch that Stan understudied Charlie in was the sketch that's called Mumming Birds, which you might have seen in the Robert Downey Jr. film, which is the sketch which Charlie Chaplin made his name, which was Fred Karner's greatest sketch, which was basically a music hall bill within a music hall bill. And they'd build a fake sort of theatre on the stage where the boxes are at the side of the stalls.
Yeah.
They would build identical boxes on the stage and the people in there wouldn't be the audience, they would be actors.
Actors, yeah.
And then you would see acts of deliberate, a music hall bill of deliberate badness, of deliberate off-key singing, and poets reciting dreadful poetry, and a wrestler called the Terrible Turkey, who would challenge people to come, who was like a string bean in a giant costume, who would challenge people to fight him.
So the people in the boxes could comment on it.
And the people in the boxes would heckle them and throw stuff. And the main character of Mumming Birds was a character called the Drunken Swell, which Sidney Chaplin played and which Charlie played, and which was the routine that made his name, kind of thing, which he played in the UK and he played in America also, and where he got spotted and picked up in my second book. But and it's the thing, and Robert Downey Jr. does it in Richard Attenborough's film, the Richard Attenborough's Chaplin film, and it's like he comes in late to the lower box on one side and tries to hang his coat up on a peg and misses and disappears, and he's drunk and he's posh. All the butts of the great Fred Karner sketches were all posh guys, usually called in one sketch after another, Archibald Binks.
Right.
Okay, this was just a thing that there'd be an Archibald Binks in all his sketches. And then the Drunken Swell character, the Chaplin character, would people be watching him trying to work out what was going on, and then he'd fall out of the thing and he'd get out of the box onto the stage and he'd get involved in the acts, and that one of the acts was a magician, and the Drunken Swell would come and try and show how his tricks were done, and then the big sort of slapstick climax of it was a wrestler who would take on all comers, and the Drunken Swell would come and he would do the classic things that Chaplin was doing for years after, you know, punching and missing and swinging right round and play the slapstick fighting. And in, meanwhile, in the upper boxes and the other boxes, there would be maybe the number two comedian who would be the main heckler, who would be like an uncle or an aunt, depending on whether it was a man in drag or someone who preferred to play as an uncle. And they would have a naughty boy character who would be the one who was mainly throwing things. And the naughty boy character was what Stan would play. And Stan would be playing that character and understudying Chaplin in the Drunken Swell thing. So if Chaplin was indisposed, but he never was, if Chaplin was indisposed, then Stan would have stepped up to do that. And everyone within a Carno company knew all the other parts. The people were kind of interchangeable. And one of the things that I write in the first book, in The Fun Factory, is Charlie Chaplin trying to find which of these parts, before he gets to play the number one part, which of these parts will show him off to best advantage. And, you know, saying, right, I'm doing that part now, and that guy had to move to this. And but they were all interchangeable cogs in a machine, and they could come out of this company and to another one that needed a magician, say, in another company in Birmingham somewhere, and he'd get on a train and go and fill in there, and someone else would fill in here. And so it was a massive organization.
How do you know all this?
I've made it up, mate.
I write fiction. I write novels.
But there are not very many, but there are some books about Fred Carno. One is called what's it called now? Master of Mirth, I think it's called. And there are some. There's one that's a little bit critical of him because he was an odd figure in his private life.
Yeah.
And there's one that was written from quite a distance up his backside. Where he can't do any wrong, kind of thing. But there are also some very good books, if anyone is particularly interested in this period, some very good books by A.J. Marriott, who is a comedy historian who writes about Chaplin Stage by Stage is his book. Mm-hmm. And it covers all these tours. It shows it's the dates of all these tours. And so I basically built the spine of my book around his research.
Why are you so fascinated by it?
I don't know, really. I mean, I'm interested in what makes comedians tick. And so I was particularly interested in the contrast between because I always loved Stan Laurel as a child, and my father loved Laurel and Hardy and brought me up on Laurel and Hardy. And I've read, Stan Laurel was never vain enough to write an autobiography, whereas Chaplin was well vain enough to do that. So people have written about Stan Laurel without, but there's some, and Laurel and Hardy both just seemed like really on screen and off, just really appealing characters, really appealing people. Whereas Chaplin always struck me as a bit of a bastard, and so you know I was drawn to the like almost defending Stan Laurel against the notion that Chaplin was the greatest that there'd ever been.
Mm. It's Stan Laurel towards the end of his life though is. He was. I know very little about this, so I could get this wrong. But he seemed to be quite saddened by it. Well, he stopped. Didn't he stop performing? Refused to be in films because he used to write.
Yes, I mean what happened was Oliver Hardy predeceased him by a good few years.
Yeah.
So Hardy wasn't in the 50s and in the period just after the Stan and Ollie film that was just out. He started to have very serious sort of health issues and lost a lot of weight and then gained a lot of weight and lost and by the end was very much thinner than he'd been. And when he died, you know, Stan Laurel didn't work again after that. But what he did for the next is he lived for another 8 years. What he would do recreationally was write more Laurel and Hardy material. He would write to entertain himself. He would write. You know, he wasn't insane and didn't think that Hardy was going to come back and do them or anything. But he was such a sort of comedy powerhouse. He was such a sort of creative powerhouse. He would still write Laurel and Hardy material.
But if anyone wrote to him, he would always reply and he would send back sketches to them.
Isn't it though? That's such a sort of he's such an appealing sort of character. Yeah, he was very meticulous about replying to correspondence and always had a good word to say for. And advice for up and coming comedians, which Chaplin, it would be anathema to Chaplin, because he would, everyone to Chaplin, even though he was on the very top rung of the ladder, everyone was a threat to him, and so he would try to keep people in their place. But Stan Laurel was very much a mentor to people like Dick Van Dyke, let's say, and Jerry Lewis, and characters who idolized him also. Mm. And to whom he would teach the physicality that he'd learned in the music hall, he would teach to them, and they all went and Dick Van Dyke made a very moving eulogy at Stan Laurel's funeral, and was responsible, I think, for the two funny gentlemen quotes that is often bandied about. But
I understand the Stan Laurel also left his phone number in the phone book.
Yeah, it was in the phone book.
So this is how you could just phone him up and talk to him about it.
That's how Dick Van Dyke got in touch with him.
Is it?
Yeah, Dick Van Dyke Dick Van Dyke in his eulogy, I think, recounted trying everything he knew to get Stan Laurel's phone number from agents and from people who'd worked with him, and blah, and no one would help him. And then he found it in the phone book, in the Santa Monica phone book.
Amazing. And my little bit of research that I did, which is,
you didn't read my book, so, you know.
Do you know what? I've listened to some of the podcast, though. It's very good. You're reading the podcast.
I am,
But you're
negative, I'm only teasing you.
You're negative towards Charlie Chaplin, but that man had an amazing amount of talent. He was even a composer who won an Oscar for his music.
He's unarguably a talented fellow.
But all these guys, because you look at them and it seems so old-fashioned sometimes when you watch it, their talent is phenomenal, isn't it?
Yeah, I think Chaplin has dated more than the others, I think. And it's partly because the staple of a Laurel and Hardy film and the staple of a Buster Keaton film also is the comedy, is the slapstick comedy, is the physical comedy. And Stan Laurel invented so many techniques that subsequent comedy films use, because film was new when he was... Sound film particularly was new when he was first working. And for instance, you know, one of the things that he invented, which you see in cartoons all the time, is, you know, Hardy would fall down the stairs and you'd fall out of the shot from the top of a staircase, and you'd hear boom, 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 him going downstairs. You'd hear "Doh!" and you'd hear a tremendous crash at the bottom of the thing, but you wouldn't see it because you're still looking at the top of the stairs. And then you'd cut down to Hardy and the house is ruined and he's, "Why don't you do something to help me?" You know, but Stan Laurel, that thing of falling out of shot and just doing it in sound, which is in Tom and Jerry, which is in Bugs Bunny, which is in countless comedy sins, is things that he was inventing, you know. And right. I think that because their first thought, Stan Laurel and Buster Keaton, let's say, but particularly Stan Laurel, his first thought was, "Where's the gag?" And he didn't mind who got the laugh as long as there was a laugh.
Right.
And so he was happy to make laughs for Oliver Hardy. And if Oliver Hardy, he used to watch, there's Dick Van Dyke, I think, tells the story of being round at his apartment, his quite a humble sort of little apartment, and they're watching Laurel and Hardy, and Laurel is just watching Hardy and going, "He was so funny. He was so funny.
Brilliant.
Look at him, he's so funny." And he doesn't watch himself, he's watching Hardy. Yeah. And I think there's a sort of selflessness to that, to that comedy. And Chaplin's is all about him. Chaplin's is a much more narcissistic presence, I think.
It's weird how it went with their comedy. So the music hall stuff was obviously, they had lines, they would sing, dance, do all that sort of stuff. Then we went to the original films, no sound apart from a soundtrack played at the top. So Chaplin, I assume Hardy and everyone, they had to invent just visual jokes.
Yes, but then that was the upbringing that they had for music hall as well. I mean, they would have lines in the sketches, but they were basically... The skills they were learning were pantomime skills, were physical skills.
So the musical stuff was basically just visual stuff.
It wasn't just anything, but it was a lot of it was physical.
Right.
I mean, there are stories that musical comedy was only pantomime because of stringent regulations put by the Lord Chancellor, censorship regulations. So they weren't allowed to have dialogue in the music hall because then it would be classified as a theatre. And I don't think that is true.
Right.
But nonetheless, these sketches were designed to play not only in this country, but also in France and in Belgium, and you know, so they had to have, they used basically the international language of pantomime. They would do dialogue, there would be dialogue, but the chief skills that they learnt were physical comedy, were slapstick comedy, were expressing what Chaplin was great at, was, you know, expressing a feeling of playing a scene through his body language, through mime. And that, as I'm sure you can imagine, once silent movies come along, that is a very transferable skill, because you're only using your body to tell a story. And that was why Chaplin was such a monster hit, because of the upbringing that he'd had in the musical in the Carnot Company.
I watched some footage the other day that suddenly they had special effects as well to work with. They had perspectives and stuff like that to work with, the view that, rather than a stage. And so Charlie Chaplin looked much more daring than he actually ever was. And
yeah, but it was an era when they would do their own stunts because they didn't know not to. Because the industry was new.
Yeah.
And there are stories of Max Sennett, who did the Keystone, who was the head of Keystone, who was one of the first producers to make Chaplin films, and did the Keystone Cops and so on. And Max Sennett himself used to play on screen. And there's a story about him doing the classic silent movie villain thing of the girl tied to the railway tracks and the train is coming.
Yeah.
And they have to get the girl just in time before the train comes. And they absolutely did that. They absolutely tied a girl to the tracks, untied her, picked her up, and moved her out of the way just in time as the train was coming. Because they didn't know how not to do it. Do you know what I mean? And they did it, and because every silent filmmaker was trying to outdo the next one. So they absolutely, and the story of the train brushing his arm and he only just, and it looks great because they nearly died. You know,
did Charlie Chaplin ever move? Because Charlie Chaplin, you know him as silent movies. Did he ever move to movies with sound? Because
yes, he did. Yes, he clung to silent movies much longer than everyone else. Because he regarded himself as this great pantomime artist, and he felt like it was the purity of his art was best expressed silently with music, but as a pantomime thing. So when silent movies came in the sort of mid late 20s, he carried on sound movies rather. When silent movies, he carried on making silent movies. When Lauren Hardy were already making sound movies.
What was the period of time then that silent movies were around for? How many
silent movies up to about 26, 27.
So when did they start?
When did which start?
The silent movies.
Silent movies. Well, there were silent movies in the first decade of the 20th century.
Right.
Chaplin started, and it was a very young industry then. Chaplin started at the end of 1913. And made dozens of short films in 1914 and became a star all around the world in 1914. So the industry was very young then, so they would be making films for 2 or 3 years before that, that were starting to get, and theatres were starting to turn into cinemas, and there were Nickelodeons that you could go in, which would show it for a nickel, obviously.
Why did they all want to go to America? Was that for the dance hall stuff or because the movie industry started?
It wasn't because of the music. The movie industry was not the thing that it is subsequently. It's not when Chaplin left the Carnot Company to go and make movies for Max Sennett. Everyone else in the company thought that he was crackers, and thought that he would never be able to come back. He'd never be able to come back to their livelihood was on the stage. They went to America because there was a big vaudeville, there were several big vaudeville circuits in America, which were like the musical circuits in the UK, but just more of them and bigger. And so Carnot would send a company every year, probably, over to America to tour the same material, but just in American vaudeville, alongside, you know, Buster Keaton and his family's act, and Harry Langdon and his act. You know.
So there was just a way to go and make money.
Yeah, there was a big thriving live performance circuit, and because before the movies, you know, that it was the same in America. Vaudeville was the people's entertainment, was spectacle, was everything.
You know? Do you know what interests me about that time is the moustache?
Well,
you know.
The moustache was yeah. I mean, obviously that toothbrush moustache is not quite. Didn't quite resonate in the same way as it does now.
But there's three people famous for it.
But it was
aren't
a
there?
Big
there's...
gift for Chaplin when he made The Great Dictator, which was a talkie during the 40s during the war, where he played essentially Hitler. He played a character called Adenoid Hinkle, who was essentially Hitler. And
but Oliver Hardy had one as well.
Oliver Hardy had one. He did. Yeah.
It's like
the nicest man.
But do we think it was perceived as a comedy moustache? And if it was, why did Adolf Hitler go, well, I'm going to have one of those then?
He was a great comedian. He was a great live act.
His speeches, honestly, they
just
were...
Just a great live act.
Nuremberg rally and everything. He got the crowd there. But, I mean, it's amazing, isn't it, that moustache?
It is. But, you know...
No one will ever wear that moustache again. Actually, Michael Jordan did.
Did he?
Have you seen the picture of Michael Jordan?
No.
All right, I'm gonna literally get this up for you.
Yeah.
Whilst I speak, because
I'm pretty sure Prince Harry has had one. Pretty sure.
Yeah. But I don't think. Okay. Yeah. Michael Jordan. I remember hearing about this.
Okay.
Hitler moustache. Sorry about this, anyone listening, but.
Well, you have to think. You have to think about Chaplin and. Oliver Hardy, it must have been a bit of a blow when Hitler started. Oh, crumbs.
He did go for it. Michael Jordan went for it. Went for the. What do you call it? What do you call it? A toothbrush?
It's a toothbrush, yeah.
Is that what it was called?
Yeah, yeah.
Do you reckon there was lots of men walking around with that, or was it just.
I imagine a lot of them just shaved them off in 1979.
but prior to that, do you think in that time that was like a look for people?
Yeah,
think it was just a comedy look?
Yeah, yeah, yeah. No, I don't think it was just a comedy look. I think it was a sort of. Because all the comedians were. Perennially playing poor men trying to look posh, and I think it was a sort of little pretentious little moustache. I think.
Yeah, because since I know I'm talking to you about this, I just as my mind does starts thinking about things, and I just thought that the clothes they wear are very clown-like, very baggy.
Yeah,
and they have the little bowler hats. Yeah. All of them. They always have a hat and stuff like that. And I was thinking, is this an exaggerated outfit of what people were wearing at the time, or is it what people were wearing at the time?
No, it's a lot of that stuff comes from Carnot. Carnot invented a lot of those sort of shorthand comedy things. I mean, Chaplin is credited, I think, certainly wrongly, for wearing a too small jacket and too large trousers,
right, okay.
And big shoes. And really, that was a staple. That was a music hall staple. There are lots of people that he nicked that from, and lots of people who claimed that they'd thought of it as well. But really, Carnot came up with a lot of that stuff. A lot of, the jacket too small, the trousers too big. That looks funny. The bendy cane that Chaplin had, that was a George Robey thing.
So do clowns come after that then? Do they like the clown outfit, the post?
It's not really a clown. It's not really connected to the clown thing.
It feels it though, doesn't it?
Yeah, yeah. But it's more of a sort of faded respectability thing. It's more of a tramp thing. It's more of a the tramp is obviously Chaplin's great apparently creation.
Yeah.
But tramp comedy was a whole genre. In the music hall and in American vaudeville, they would all do that. They would all. It was a tramp thing more than it was a clown thing.
Why have you done it as a podcast?
The thing is, I spent a lot of time on the books, and the first one came out now 5 years ago, and the podcast thing seemed to be an interesting way to breathe sort of new life into it, to make it a live project, to put some things also around the edge of it that you can't put. You're always perennially cutting things from a book. Mm. A book is always twice as long as it needs to be, and the ideas that you can't put into it. And with a podcast, I can talk to people about it, and I can read the book, and people can hear it as an experience. But also, we're hoping to talk to some people like yourself. We talk to some people about it as well, and so then it becomes a denser, richer sort of experience.
Feels like this is crying out to be a Netflix series to me.
Doesn't it though?
It does, yeah. And it, but you know the way Netflix works, you know, they, the few good things about Netflix is they refuse to launch, the, release their ratings. And they also, they've also got formulas they do. And I think this is so their formula because of the Steve Coogan film, which was really popular, as we know, that worked. People love the dance hall stuff, you know.
And
the idea that there's a narrative where Charlie Chaplin's not the nicest guy either, I think is so up their
street. The difficult thing is to get something like this in front of those people, partly because it's really difficult. I've discovered it's another reason for doing it as a podcast, actually. It's really difficult to put a book in front of someone and have them read it. You know, even if you're Netflix and you're desperate and voracious for content, you know, they want to see 200 words about it, you know. And even I tried to get it away as a Radio 4 serial. And, you know, an offers round comes around and you can't show them the book. You're not allowed to, you know, they won't read the book. You have to basically write, jot a couple of things on the back of an envelope, and then it goes along with, it's up against an idea that someone else has had in the pub the day before, you know.
Yeah, isn't that the beautiful thing about podcasting now? And the great thing about YouTube is if you've got an idea for a film or a sketch or something, you can go, hey, I can make that and stick it out there. And at least you've made it. And like, you've written these books, which obviously take a lot of work, but you can go, as you say, breathe a new life into it and just offer it to another medium. So maybe I'm more...
I think so. And I think you keep it, you keep it feeling like it's got a pulse, you know. And I think we'll get to a point where, you know, Netflix guy, you try, you get to speak to Netflix guy and you say to him, I've written these three books, they'd make a cracking three series, if you like, of on Netflix. And you go, oh, and you'll see in his, behind his eyes, you'll go, oh, books. I've got to read a book. And you say, well, it's also a podcast, so you can listen to it on the train or you can listen to it in the gym, you know.
Yeah.
And you make it available to people won't read a book, you know, who won't cart a book around with
them. To me, I don't read, I read lots of books, as you can see on the table.
I can see many books.
There's loads of books. But
one called Hog, I can see just there. Yeah, I don't think what that is.
That's the cookbook.
Is that pork or is that motorbikes?
Yeah, it's it is pork, yeah.
Okay,
cool. I've got all these cookbooks here, but I don't actually use any of them, if I'm honest with you. That's decoration.
But they're very showy, they're lovely.
All the ones on the table are the ones that I'm trying to read at the moment and get through. I'm just reading The Paradox of Choice, that's a good one. I recommend that. The Miracle Mornings. I read all these, but I don't sit down and read novels ever. But listening to your podcast, I thoroughly enjoyed it because you suddenly get engaged in the story.
Hopefully that's part of it's hard sometimes to get into a book, and you know, books start, as I'm finding now, trying to adapt the first one into TV episodes, into an offer of TV episodes, let's say. Books can start in a different way to a TV thing, and what people are geared up for mentally is something that starts bang and you're right in the middle of it. And a book will start more gently than that, and sometimes that works against you, people engaging in it, you know. And so it's kind of a dying sort of skill to read a novel, I think. And but people will enjoy it.
I think
it.
People are getting more into it.
I think that it's one of the things which is good about doing it as a podcast is that people can dedicate, let's say, 30 or 40 minutes to listening to that while they're doing something else, or while they're on the way somewhere, or while they're out for a jog or something like that. And by that time, by the time they've heard 30, 40 minutes of it, they're into that then. And it's hard to get into a book if it doesn't grab you straight away.
Well, I've listened to a bit of it, but I've decided next time I listen to it, I'm going to listen to it on times 2 speed up, because that's very silent movie. Very silent movie.
But actually, my voice works really well.
What do you think's going on in there? Obviously, those guys have had such an influence throughout. I mean, still physical comedy, which is sort of invented by them. Still, you know, everybody's still doing that everywhere. Where do you think we're at with the comedy movement at the moment? I'm calling it a movement.
Okay,
industry.
Yeah, it's not really a movement, is it? It's an industry. It's definitely an industry. I mean, I think to be a comedian now, you've got a much more structured career path than has ever been available before. And you can see a straight line from I'll put together 10 minutes of a stand-up act, and then I'll do, then I'll get bigger and bigger gigs, then I'll get on a TV panel show, then I'll maybe have a special, then I'll do this. And then, particularly in America, these are the people they look to be actors, and the assumption that if you're a good stand-up comedian, you'll be, that'll transfer to comedy acting, is one that's very prevalent in America.
Hmm.
It's kind of a little bit less so here, I think, because one or two comedians, without naming the name of Josh Widdicombe, have had a sitcom in which you see them acting in a way that doesn't quite give you what they give you as a stand-up. Do you know what I mean?
I've got to say, by the way, that you are a writer of comedy as well as you've written with four comedians. You've written Evening with Gary Lineker, a play. You write films. Yeah, you're writing everything,
all sorts of things. Yeah,
yeah, I mean, I've books
from books and films and some that have been made and play, and some that have not, and plays for theatre, yeah, and radio, and so I've tried to do. Anything that comes along, really. I'd like to have a go. I'd like to try everything once.
How's that process? Because, I mean, I couldn't think about writing. I've been trying to write a book, actually, as the viewers of this podcast.
So you have been thinking about it? Yeah.
I have been thinking about it, but I just literally don't know where to start. I can't be bothered. I mean, it's... It is the truth. I'm struggling with that.
I mean, it's... I think... Every writer will tell you a different that they work in a different way, and for me it's a lot of displacement activity. You know, it's a lot of I'll do a bit of writing, but that needs doing first. And I'll do it, and then about 4 o'clock, I think if I don't do anything now, I've wasted the whole day. But on Sky Atlantic, there's an old West Wing, and so I'll let the rabbit out for a run, and then I'll do something at 5. You know, a lot of it is displacement activity. I'm very suspicious, I must say, of people who tell you their writing schedule.
Right.
And, I remember reading, a few years ago, someone asked Jeffrey Archer, how do you write, Jeffrey? What's the process? You know, Jeffrey Archer of all people. I know he may have been in jail at the time, but Jeffrey Archer said...
Not a lot to do.
Jeffrey Archer said, well, what I do is I get up, I write between 7 and 9 in the morning. Then I have breakfast, 9 until 9:30. And then I write again from 9:30 to 11:30. And then I have 11:30 till 12. I have a cup of coffee and a biscuit. And then I write again from 12 o'clock until 2 o'clock. And then at 2 o'clock I have lunch. And then the rest of the day is mine. And I thought, no wonder your books are shit, man. Because, that is just, you can't, I can't force it in that way. I can't say, I'll sit down and write now and I'll write whatever comes in the time that I'm sitting and writing. For me, writing is a 24-hour thing. It's a 24/7 thing.
Yeah.
I'm thinking about a story, and I'll have an idea while I'm doing something else, while I'm walking, and then I'll sit down and write it when it comes to me.
Yeah.
But I'm thinking about it all the time.
Do you enjoy it?
Yes, I do. It's what I set out to do, and I still enjoy doing it, yeah.
Mm. I found when I was writing just scripts for TV shows and things, Big Breakfast or the Soccer M or something, that I could only get motivated when the deadline was coming.
Yeah,
and
then well, sure. Like, I mean, wow, that's a big thing. That is a big thing, yeah. What I found with the Fun Factory books was that I didn't really have a deadline, because my publisher was very laid back, and he would occasionally ask me how it was going, but it was kind of left to my own devices. So I was very lucky, I think, in 2013, 14, 15, when I was writing the first two, that I was also doing the radio show that I did with Mark, the 7-day Sunday or Saturday, which we did initially with Chris Addison. Mm. On Radio 5, and Andy Zaltzman, a very funny man. And it was like a weekly thing. So there'd be 2 days a week when I was doing that. And then that was keeping me going, keeping my head above water. And then the rest of the week, I would write these. And so I got a long way during each series of 7-day Saturday or Sunday, whichever it was at the time. I'd move the books on a lot in that time, because you've got another thing to focus on. It's a different sort of writing. It's a different sort of thing you're trying to come up with, and it does have a deadline, and you do have to do it.
Did Stan Laurel or Charlie Chaplin have people who wrote with them?
No, I would say basically no. But Stan Laurel, one of the things that was really interesting about the two of them, about their relationship, was that Charlie Chaplin was... And I knew they were roughly contemporary. And Charlie Chaplin was the most famous man on the planet all of a sudden in 1914. And Stan Laurel tried to be a solo silent comedian, but the early film stock didn't suit him because he had red hair and he had very bright blue eyes, and so his eyes looked, in the very early primitive film stock, his eyes looked oddly sort of empty. And so he didn't really play as a silent comedian. So by the time he met and made films with Oliver Hardy in 1927, something like that, Chaplin, he'd had to live with Chaplin being the biggest star in the world for 13 years.
Right.
And had more or less given up on his own performing career. And he was a gag man and a producer. And he was writing gags for other people. And he was... and. It was part of his makeup that he liked creating comedy, and he would always say he didn't mind who got the laugh as long as there was a laugh. Mm. And so he was writing gags and producing silent comedy films for what you would think now, looking back, for far inferior comedians to himself. But he was like this powerhouse of creativity.
Chaplin had blue eyes. There's my research.
Did he?
You're saying no to that.
I'm saying no to that, yeah. Chaplin had a very sort of dark purple coloured eyes. That was his thing. That was the odd thing about him.
Maybe I've got my Stan Laurel research and my Charlie Chaplin research mucked up. Maybe I've mucked that up.
No, you'll read, I'm sure different things will tell you different things.
I thought they said Charlie Chaplin, and they said that the black and white film suited him because everyone... Didn't they say that? I thought they said that when people met him, they couldn't believe it's Charlie Chaplin because he had different coloured eyes because they look so dark on... No,
I've not heard that.
No, okay.
I've not heard
I'll dig out my research notes.
Yeah. Well, you know, all the people who said that are dead now.
Just going back to writing rooms, just because you've been in a load of them, and it's interesting for
With
me.
Monk,
in, they're small though over here, aren't they? In America, they get these huge rooms full of 10, 15 people to write, say for Saturday Night Live or one of the talk shows comedy shows, and they have all these writing rooms. Over here, we keep the numbers down a lot smaller.
Yeah, I mean, we haven't really got
the... Is it just budget?
It is, and we've never really got the hang of working a big writing room thing. It's partly because you need a writing room to run a series that is going to be 22 episodes long, and we don't really do that. We do six that one person can manage.
Why do we do that? Why have we gone different ways?
How our TV is developed. I mean, in America, everything runs on an annual cycle, where the fall schedule is the big thing, where the new series start in September, October, and they run for 22 weeks up to Easter, half the year.
Yeah.
And then April, May, they're selecting the things for the next fall schedule. And this series that's run from September to Easter runs again over the summer as a repeat, and then run and hopefully into season two. But here we don't have an annual cycle that works in that way. So they have, that February, March, people are making pilots. April to offer for the next fall season, and then the networks decide in May, and they announce in a big announcement what's going to be in the fall schedule, what's going to be kept, what's going to be axed, what's going to be new, and things work on a schedule that is basically 6 months long. And sometimes, especially now, there's HBO and Netflix and things like that. Things now, Stranger Things, for instance, there'll be 10 episodes of that. But that's a Netflix thing. Mm. And it doesn't operate on the same schedule. Now there's a box set philosophy where everything is released at once, where you can get access to everything and you can binge it in the first week. But historically, our TV schedules are much more piecemeal than that. And our slots are much smaller than that. And our sitcoms would typically be six perfect episodes of Fawlty Towers. And in America, they tried it in America, but in America, they'd have milked that for 22 until you were tired to death of it.
But don't you think it would work as 22 episodes of Fawlty Towers?
Yeah, for sure. But you wouldn't have the same, you would have killed Cleese and Connie Booth doing that much material because they were such perfectionists, and they were so they took so much time to do an episode, and it's just a different system. And it works if you watch an episode of, let's say, the old sitcom Malcolm in the Middle in America.
Yeah.
You know, I happen to, just because I know a couple of the guys who work on that, so I can tell you a little bit about how that worked. But you see at the beginning of that show, there are a lot of people credited as producers or executive producers or as creative producers or something like that. And two of those guys were the showrunners, who and the rest of them were writers, and the scripts would rotate around the writing room, and someone would take the responsibility for one episode, but everyone would then contribute to that, and then the showrunners would decide what material ended up in that. And so there was a homogeneity about the style of the thing, which came from the writing room, which came from the process where it had to go through executive producers who were dictating the style of the show. But basically the episodes were structurally and initially being written by one person or two people.
Do you think American sitcoms are better than ours?
By and large, it's more of an industry over there. It's more of a, I mean, they tend to be, because of this thing, because of the 22 episode thing.
Yeah.
There tends to be a thing with American sitcoms where there's not so much, occasionally romantically, but there's not so much progression from one thing to the next. So that you tend to deal with. There's a little bit in something like Big Bang Theory, for instance, where the two characters get together in one season, and that's a romance across one season. But they tend to be, episode to episode, they tend to do the sitcom reset, where at the end of the episode, everything's pretty much what it was at the beginning. Because the thing has to be 22 episodes long, and the guy who's writing episode 17 needs to know that the characters are going to be the same and the situation's basically going to be the same while they're making the episodes at the beginning of the series.
Yeah.
So there's a sort of industrial aspect to that, but the quality is generally very strong, I think, of American comedy. But partly because it's clever people, it's a lot of clever people contributing.
Last time you came on, I asked you all the questions, so I won't go through those. The ones I asked normal people, but I will ask.
I'm not
you,
a normal person. I think
you're
found
not
it
a normal
out the first
person.
Time.
Is I will ask you two questions. Okay. One is, can you recommend another book? I can't remember the first book you recommended, but can you recommend another? Good
yeah,
book
I can remember the first book that I recommended, which was The Right Stuff, I think.
Right,
but. Another favourite book I can recommend, just off the top of my head, if you've never read, you should, is Adventures in the Screen Trade by William Goldman, which is a fantastic anecdotal how the film industry worked in the 70s and 80s. Some terrific things. I mean, he wrote his big breakthrough hit thing was Butch Cassidy and the Sundance Kid in right. the late 60s. And there's a chapter about how he came up with that and what he had to go through to get it made. And it's and there are two volumes of this as well. I think there's more Adventures in the Screen Trade. And he's written some good books about this with some great anecdotes in.
I love the evolution of our industries. Because it is quite mad how quickly it changes, really.
Yeah, yeah.
We've got on demand now. And you were just talking about schedules then. Commissioners used to, they wait for the schedules to come in. Traditionally over here, as you know, BBC and ITV and Channel 4. And then they try and put programmes up against other shows to try and kill their shows.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
I mean, that's nuts, because they're supposed to be offering a service for the viewer.
Yeah.
But what they're doing is protecting their percentage
yeah,
share.
It is nuts. It is nuts.
It's but now it's on demand, and people aren't just watching stuff live. There are live stuff like The X Factor and Strictly and stuff like that. I suppose Saturday night there's the football. There's shows like mine on a Sunday, which, you know, some people watch. But a lot of people are watching stuff on demand now. So it's changing the way the commissioners have to view TV shows.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, there's much more of a binge box set mentality, particularly to big scale things, big drama things and comedy things also. There used to be big scheduling things that were very funny in America, things that were put opposite one another in America.
Yeah.
But I remember, this is a thing that I wrote maybe 20 years ago. I wrote a sitcom that was on ITV and for one series and was doing all right. I was getting ratings that would just, they would chop their arms off for now, because the system was different. You know,
yeah.
More audience were available. But the BBC tried to spike it, and they put up against our last episode, they put the rerun of the Only Fools and Horses episode with the Batman and Robin,
oh, that wow. one,
which had been the biggest, which was a year old then. but it had been the previous Christmas. But it was the biggest audience for a comedy show that there'd been, apart from, I think, one episode of The Good Life.
Right.
And they thought, then suddenly they reran it against our last episode and just blew us out of there.
What was it? Your show?
It was called Blind Men. And it was about a showroom for salesmen selling blinds.
Oh. Is that... Yeah. It's the old gag where they knock at the door and the woman's naked.
Is in episode one.
Is it? That is absolutely brilliant.
But no, it was
the whole sitcom written on the basis of that joke?
Yeah, after like the advert break in episode one, I had nothing left after that.
That's tremendous. So the other question I was going to ask you, what's your recommended book? Now recommend something we should watch on TV. What do you think we should
watch on TV? The thing that I like the most at the moment is a thing that I'm watching in a box set binge sort of way.
Yeah.
Is a thing that's on Sky Atlantic and it's called Succession.
Oh, I can't get enough of that. Succession. Oh, how good is that?
I think Succession is fantastic.
So I'm on a Netflix detox, as Mark will tell you. I'm not doing Netflix. I'm not trying to do Amazon Prime. And then someone said to me, watch Succession. I thought, oh, I'm going to give it. I like to be abreast of everything which is going on.
Yeah.
Watch the first episode and now I'm binging it. It was only last week I started. I'm now nearly at the end of the first series.
I think I've got three more of season two to go.
The characters are brilliant.
They're brilliant.
They?
And the actors are brilliant.
The writing's fantastic.
Yeah.
That,
and it's run by Jesse Armstrong, who wrote Peep Show with his mate Sam Bain, I think he's called.
Right.
So I beg your pardon. But and he's gone off to America to run that show. And
any old sitcoms that you think that we should... What's the one you really... American or British that you think, that's my thing?
Like that's my thing.
Seinfeld or something.
Seinfeld is matchlessly good, I think.
Right.
I quote Seinfeld probably more than anything apart from I'm Alan Partridge.
Right.
I'm Alan Partridge, I think. The very first episode of I'm Alan Partridge, where he's living in the Travel Tavern, the Linton Travel Lodge. And he comes down and is asking for a second series and doesn't get one. And his car's been graffitied.
Yeah, yeah.
And he runs out to the BBC with cheese. And he and he's buying a big bastard house. and he has a little reverie at the end about imagining if he was living in the house, which is now no longer possible. And he's going to invite Chris Rea over for a barbecue. I think it's the most perfect episode of anything.
Right.
The first episode. If that's on, I'll always watch it.
One of my favourite scenes from Alan Partridge is when he's doing the Dan in the car park. Dan, constantly. If you watch the two women, you know, his PA and his girlfriend, they've lost it. They're corpsing because he wasn't supposed to go that long with the Dan. And because one of them came on one of my shows once and they said, we start laughing. And we showed the clip. And if you watch them, their shoulders are going and everything as they're trying their hardest. And one of them turns around and then has to turn straight back. And if you watch that back again, it's just another bonus for you.
Yeah, there are some perfect moments in those two series. In the one where he's living in the caravan as well. There's a thing where he's playing along with an air bass guitar to is it Gary Newman, I think, and then there's a knock on the door and he turns the music off and he mime takes the air guitar off and then realizes what he's doing and just waves his hands at it. It's just fantastic.
Do you think these things should carry on going though, or do you think, like, if we brought back 40 Towers now, it'd be crap, wouldn't it? Do you think because he does keep bringing that character back, doesn't he?
He does, and it's such a genius creation that there's always something. I mean, I didn't quite go for his one show series that was recently, but there were still some very good things in it. Very good things in it. The reason why I would put the I'm Alan Partridge right at the top is there are episodes that where he simply doesn't put a foot wrong, where everything in it is great, where he drops Lynn off to visit her mother's grave, and in the car he's playing along on his steering wheel to the theme from Return of the Saint, which is just fantastic. It's not the Saint, it's Return of the Saint. It's just fantastically good.
Last question for you then, because this interests me. I'm a massive fan of Bob Mortimer and
Vic
Reeves, but Bob comes on my TV show quite a lot, and I always say to him, well, you know, how can you like just keep going and going? And he goes, we don't have a lot of competition. Mm. There's not many people who come along and do surreal comedy like Vic and Bob do. There's been the Mighty Boosh, which was amazing.
Yeah.
And I think he names two or three other things. He said, but it's not like everybody wants to do the stand-up thing.
Mm.
And he said, he's always so shocked that there's not more young people coming along and going, hey, we're going to take on Vic and Bob. There's just not that much competition. Yeah, yeah. Why do you think that is?
I think it's because, as we started to say earlier, that there's such a sort of, there's such an obvious now career path, and it's an industrial thing. You can see that if you want to get to where, let's say, where Bob Mortimer is now, where he's going fishing with Paul Whitehouse and he's on Would I Lie to You, you know, you get there by, you don't get there by doing by taking on Vic and Bob. You get there by doing your 10 minutes in a club, then doing half an hour, then doing a special, then you work your way that way. And it's such an obvious, well-trodden career path. You know, you get a Live at the Apollo and then you get your own hour kind of thing. It's all laid out in front of you now in a way that it was always very much more piecemeal before. Mm. And the comedy heroes of mine in the 70s, let's say, in the 80s, were doing sketch comedy or were the Python people who were doing films, but not the 9 o'clock news. And then later, Harry Enfield and Paul Whitehouse, and the Fast Show, it was sketch comedy, where one of the things that you liked about Michael Palin, let's say, was how very versatile he was and how he was different in everything. And Paul Whitehouse, just a genius.
Amazing.
And Harry also. But the things that they, the range that they show is one of the things you enjoy about them. Mm. And now comedy is narrowed into projecting your own personality, I think, in a way. And there are still sketch shows, but they're looked down upon now in a way that they weren't.
I love Paul White. But they can't do them now, can they? Because of the I hate to use this expression, but the PC movement or whatever, you know, the woke movement. It's tough to do them because as soon as you do a character of someone...
Yeah, you do one sketch and then that gets a
Little
reviewed
Britain
in
could
that
never
way.
Be on TV now.
Little Britain would find it hard. They'd find it hard now. But then they're doing it. They're doing again, aren't they? They're doing a
radio
again.
Show.
They're doing a
little radio
Brexit or something. They're doing.
Yeah. I went to a preview. By the way, I love Bob Mortimer and Paul Whitehouse's Fishing. I love that show because I just like listening to those two. But I went to a preview of it, and they were both there, interviewed by Charlie Hickson, which was one of the funniest things ever. They were just hammering Charlie constantly. But their humour's very different, but they complement each other. And after the Bob went, oh, hi, Tim, what do you think? And then Paul Whitehouse went, hi, Tim, what do you think? And I was like, I can't believe they both called me by my name. You know, it's like just because they're such heroes to me. They make me laugh so much. And following Bob Mortimer on Twitter is just a pure joy. That he just understands that medium more than anyone else. Everyone else is arguing and shouting and trying to do crass gags. He's giving you a year lease on a cat's name for 10 quid. And I mean, it's like, it's mental and it's brilliant. And just like all that stuff. And now he's taken on Instagram. And yourself a favor, if you haven't got Instagram, get it just to follow Bob, because he is putting stuff up there and it's literally tens of thousands of people are liking it and retweeting.
Yeah, I'm not surprised. I mean, he's such an out and out funny presence.
Oh, he's amazing.
The things he does on Would I Lie to You, where he's talking about doing his own dentistry.
Yeah,
and he's Chris Rea putting an egg in his. That's the second time I've mentioned Chris Rea. Chris Rea putting an egg in his bath. You know, my sons, Peter, John, Michael, they love Bob Mortimer and they don't remember Reeves and Mortimer. They love him from Would I Lie to You?
Oh, it's amazing. Brilliant. Thanks, Chris. Thanks for doing the podcast.
It's a pleasure.
Where can people listen to your podcast, by the way? Usual places and stuff?
I guess, let's say usual places, because then
we'll put the links on it. It's called The Fun Factory, isn't it?
The Fun Factory, that's right. Cool.
Cheers, Chris. Thanks.
Thank you very much.
That was Chris England. Mark, where can people listen to your podcast?
They can go to iTunes, or they can go to Acast, or they can go to Stitcher, or they can go to Spotify, and it's available in all those places. Mm.
I like talking about comedy. Obviously, I'm not an expert on it, but I know what makes me laugh.
It's me, isn't it?
No, not really. Always Sunny in Philadelphia, I think, is my favourite. You didn't really get it. You didn't get into it, did you?
No, I don't like cringy stuff, really.
I think it's a little bit more clever than that, Mark. Yeah. But
it's not as good as Friends, obviously.
Well, that is your favourite, isn't it?
No, it isn't. No,
yes, it is.
It isn't my favourite.
Oh, is Joey being stupid again? Oh, is Ross whinging?
I tell you a thing I noticed the other day, which really made me laugh. There was an episode on the other day, how big Ross's shirts were.
Really?
They're like massive.
Are you still watching Friends?
Oh, yeah.
After all these years?
Yeah.
Yeah. I've never really watched Friends. I've said this to you before. I think it was because I was out.
Yeah, because Friends, you were cool in the 90s.
I was out and we didn't have on demand back then. So I'd have to watch it on video and I didn't bother that. So what's your favourite? Have you got any like hidden gems, comedy gems?
Well, it's not hidden, but it's still the one I go back to all the time, which is Whatever Happened to the Likely Lads.
Ah, yeah.
And there's only, again, you were talking with Chris.
Can you watch that anywhere now?
I've got the DVDs and it's sometimes on the iPlayer.
Right.
But there was only sort of two proper series and then like a Christmas special and... And the odd special here and there. There was the Light Lads, which was the original black and white one. But they're the best. They're like little play. Everyone's like a little play. Yeah. I love those.
15 Stories by Sean.
Oh, I remember that. Yeah,
is it right. Called 15 Stories?
Yes, it was.
15 Stories yes. High or something by Sean Locke.
And it had Benedict Wong in it, who is so funny.
It is incredible. It's so funny. And they moved that all around the schedule, so it didn't work. And it was, I think, I went and talked to Sean Locke about it once. I think he said it was, they started putting on at 12 o'clock at night or something. It's ridiculous. But there's very small little scenes in that as well, always, which is just, if you get a chance, go. It's all on YouTube that, but just look up Boys Are Cool, which is really funny, where the what's his name, Peter Serafinovich, he's the manager of a boy band, and he goes, I've got the name, it's called Boys Are Cool, because if you say it quickly it says bicycle, which is just great. And he goes, you just got to watch it on YouTube. Yeah. It really does make me laugh. But he's writing on that. It's just absolutely brilliant.
Peter Serafinovich is another guy who...
He's brilliant.
He should be on absolutely everything ever, I think.
He's funny.
Yeah.
All right, that's it. We've got to talk about our sponsors. We love our sponsors. That is Cooker, spelt Quicker, pronounced Cooker. 100 degree boiling hot water straight from your kitchen tap. Some people say, why on earth would you have boiling hot water coming from a tap? Surely that's dangerous. But it took Mark about 2 weeks.
I'm annoyed because I was going to use that, and I don't think you should be allowed to say that about me. I think I should be able to say that about myself.
You can't literally turn the tap on, can you? No. But no one can just literally turn the tap on.
I'd like to think not thicker than a 3-year-old.
Yeah, I can't remember what they call it. It's a push. No, you are thicker than the 3-year-old.
Okay,
I think it's push and turn system or something. So you got to push this lever twice, then turn it. It's like a code to get in. So like if you've got kids or something, you can't do it. Anyway, I love it because it's got the 100 degree boiling hot water. It's got the filtered water, and it's got the sparkling filtered water, which Mark drinks far too much of. I've had to buy some more bottles of that because Mark's gone through all my bottles. But I don't mind because I like him. Anyway, go to, I suppose it's cooker.com, I suppose. I'm not sure actually of the email address. Maybe I should look that up. We'll put it in our blurb at the bottom.
It's always
anyway.
In the blurb, Tim.
It's always in the blurb. So anyway, that's it for this week. We've got loads more podcasts coming up, some really exciting ones. Please feedback what you think of them as well. We love it when we hear from you. We've had some really nice stuff recently. As I say, the theory we've been going through with this podcast is we're not just going to go for celebrity, even though we know when we put celebrity, we get more hits. We want to make sure we keep this whole thing interesting and just do lots of different varied subjects. So let us know whether we're still hitting the mark with that. You can tweet me. You know what we should do? We should make it a bit more pro. We should cut here and you go, this was recorded in front of a live studio or something like that. Or this,
but it wasn't.
All right. Well, what about something like, this is the Dear Lovejoy podcast. If you want to contact us like the pros do, can you do that for this one?
That sounds like a bit too much work.
Go on. Or you can put it to music as well. You can run the theme tune under it and you can go, if you want to contact us, dearlovejoypodcast@gmail.com, or you can contact Tim Lovejoy.
Or you could just do it now. Do your job.
Yeah, no, you do it. Go on. Anyway, that's it for the time being. Let us know what you think. Peace and love, Joy.
Bye.